Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is the L.A. Steel Show, and tonight I want to read an essay by Ralph Waldo Emerson, who is one of my favorite writers of all time. For those of you who tuning into this, you're probably aware of who Ralph Waldo Emerson is, but he wrote some great articles, some great essays, and actually timeless essays that I have been reading over many years that we've been on the air now. It's been since November 2006 we've been on this program. We've been on radio since 2003 and been on television since 1999. But this particular program tonight I dedicate to all the idealists out there, people who believe in things that, I think Emerson sizes it up best. It's not a very long essay, and if we have time, we'll probably go into another. But definitely, I wanted to touch on this tonight. Now, Ralph Waldo Emerson, for those of you who might be tuning in, was born. Let me give you a little description about Ralph. I like to call him Ralph. Actually, he liked to be called Waldo. I kind of prefer Ralph. But was born in Boston on May 25th, 1803, and the descendant of a long line of ministers. After his father's death, his mother moved her five sons to Concord, Massachusetts, to raise them with the help of Emerson's aunt, Mary Moody Emerson. Entering Harvard at 14, imagine that, entering Harvard University at 14, Emerson showed little promise of becoming America's first great thinker and graduated in the bottom half of his class. He was tubercular, restless, and already questioning the religion of his fathers. Emerson nevertheless entered the ministry in 1826 and became an associate pastor of Boston's Second Church, Unitarian. But in 1831, unable in good conscience to administer the Eucharist and following the faith, following the death of his young wife, Ellen Tucker, he resigned from his position. In 1832 trip to Europe further influenced his ideas of the Oversoul, and he began a lifelong friendship with Thomas Carlyle. And upon his return, he settled in Concord and married Lydia Jackson. His first book, Nature, published in 1836, summarized his major ideas and put him in the center of the New England Transcendentalists, who included Margaret Fuller, Bronson Alcott, and Henry Thoreau. With the publication of Essays, the first series in 1841, and Essays, a second series, 1844, his position as their leading figure was established, and from 1842 to 1844, he edited the Dial magazine. In 1847, he published poems and returned to Europe, where he delivered the lectures and appeared in Representative Men in 1850. A prolific author, his complete works fill 40 volumes, and he lives in Concord, in Concord, Massachusetts, and was revered as a thinker and writer until his death in 1882. I'm reading from this work tonight. Idealism is what we'll be talking about. And I guess the reason I'm reading this is because I'm an idealist. There's no getting around that. I believe in altruism. I'm an altruist. I admit that. But I'm also a cynic. I'm skeptical. But at the same time, I like to keep myself optimistic in the sense that even, regardless if I denigrate something or satirize some political thing or person or something or other in current events, I can't help myself, and I tend to gravitate toward idealism. And I think Emerson said it best in this: "Thus is the unspeakable but intelligible and practical meaning of the word conveyed to man, the immortal pupil in every object of sense. To this one end of discipline, all parts of nature conspire." A noble doubt perpetually suggests itself whether this end be not the final cause of the universe, and whether nature outwardly exists. It is a sufficient account of what appearances we call the world, that God will teach a human mind, and so make it the receiver of a certain number of congruent sensations, which we call sun and moon, man and woman, house and trade. In my utter impotence to test the authenticity of the report of my senses, to know whether the impressions they make on me correspond with outlying objects, what difference does it make whether Orion is up there in heaven or some god paints the image in the firmament of the soul? The relations of parts and the end of the whole remaining same, what is the difference whether land and sea interact and worlds revolve and intermingle without number or end, and deep yawning under deep and galaxy balancing galaxy throughout absolute space, or whether without relations of time and space, the same appearances are inscribed in this constant faith of man. Whether nature enjoy a substantial existence without, or is only in the apocalypse of the mind, it is alike useful and alike venerable to me. Be it what it may, it is ideal to me so long as I cannot try the accuracy of my senses. The frivolous make themselves merry with the ideal theory, as if its consequences were burlesque, as if it affected the stability of nature. It surely does not, and God never jests with us, and will not compromise the end of nature by permitting any inconsequence in its procession. Any distrust of the permanence of laws would paralyze the faculties of man. Their permanence is sacred, respected, and his faith therein is perfect. The wheels and springs of man are all set to the hypothesis of the permanence of nature. We are not built like a ship to be tossed, but like a house to stand. It is a natural consequence of the structure that so long as the active powers predominate over the reflective, we resist with indignation any hint that nature is more short-lived or mutable than spirit. The broker, the wheelwright, the carpenter, the tollman are much displeased at the intimation. But whilst we acquire entirely in the permanence of natural laws, the question of the absolute existence of nature still remains open. It is the uniform effect of culture on the human mind, not to shake our faith in the stability of a particular phenomenon, as of heat and water, azote, but to lead us to regard nature as phenomenon, not a substance to attribute necessary existence to spirit, to esteem nature as an accident and an effect. To the senses that the unrenewed understanding belongs a sort of instinctive belief in the absolute existence of nature. In their view, in nature are indissolubly joined. Things are ultimates, and they never look beyond their sphere. The presence of reason mars this faith. The first effort of thought tends to relax the despotism of the senses, which binds us to nature as if we were a part of, and shows us nature aloof, and as it were, afloat. Until this higher agency intervened, the animal eyes sees, and wonderful accuracy, sharp outlines and colored surfaces. When the eyes of reason opens to outline and surface, are at once added grace and expression. These proceed from imagination and affection and abate somewhat of the angular distinctiveness of objects. If the reason be stimulated to more earnest visions, outlines and surfaces become transparent and are no longer seen. Causes and spirits are seen through them. In the best moment of life are these delicious awakenings of the higher powers, and the reverential withdrawing of nature before its God. Let us proceed to indicate the effect of culture. Our first institution in the ideal philosophy is a hint from nature herself. Nature is made to conspire with spirit to emancipate us. And concern mechanical changes, a small alteration in our local position apprises us of dualism. We are strangely affected by seeing the shore from a moving ship, from a balloon, or through the tints of an unusual sky. The least change in our point of view gives the whole world a pictorial air. A man who seldom rides needs only to get into a coach and traverse his own town to turn the street into a puppet show. The men and women talking, running, bartering, fighting, and earnest mechanic, the lounger, the beggar, the boys, the dogs, are unrealized at once, or at least wholly detached from all relations to the observer, and seen as apparent, not substantial beings. What new thoughts are suggested by seeing a face of country quite familiar in the rapid movement of the railroad car, nay, the most wanted objects make a very slight change in this point of vision. Please us most, in a camera obscura, the butcher's cart and the figure of one or more own family amuse us. So a portrait of a well-known face gratifies us. Turn the eyes upside down by looking at the landscape through your legs, and how agreeable is the picture, though you may have seen it any time these 20 years. In these cases, by mechanical means, is suggested the difference between the observer and the spectacle, between man and nature, and hence arise a pleasure mixed with awe. I may say a low degree of the sublime is felt from the fact, probably, that man is hereby apprised that whilst the world is a spectacle, something in himself is stable. In a higher manner, the poet communicates the same pleasure. By a few strokes, he delineates, as on air, the sun, the mountain, the camp, the city, the hero, the maiden, not different from what we know them, but only lifted from the ground and afloat upon the eyes, afloat before the eye. He unfixes land and the sea and makes them revolve around the axis of his primary thought, and disposes them anew. Possessed himself by a heroic passion, he uses matters as symbols of it. The sensual man conforms thoughts to things, the poet conforms things to his thoughts. And the one esteems nature as rooted and fast, and other as fluid and impresses, he being thereon. To him, the refractory world is ductile and flexible. He invests dust and stones with humanity and makes them the words of the reason. The imagination may be defined to be the use which reason makes of the material world. Shakespeare possesses the power of subordinating nature for the purposes of expression, beyond all poets. His imperial muse tosses the creation like a bottle from hand to hand, and uses it to embody any caprice or thought that is uppermost in his mind. The remotest spaces of nature are visited, and the farthest sundered things are brought together by a subtle spiritual connection. We are made aware that magnitude of material things is relative, and all objects shrink and expand to serve the passion of the poet. And thus, in his sonnets, the lays of birds and scents and dyes of color he finds to be the shadow of his beloved time, which keeps her from him, as his chest, the suspicion, she has awakened in her ornament. The ornament of beauty is suspect, a crow which flies in heaven's sweetest air. His passion is not fruit of chance, it swells as he speaks to a city or a state. No, it was built it farther from accident. It suffers not in smiling pomp nor falls. And upon the brow of thralling discontent, it fears not policy, that heretic that works on leases of short numbered hours, but all along stands hugely prolific. In the strength of his constancy, the pyramid seems to him recent and transitory. The freshness of youth and love dazzles him with its resemblance to mourning. And take those lips away which so sweetly were forsworn, and those eyes and days of break of day, lights that do mislead the morn. The wild beauty of his hyperbole, I may say in passing, it would not be easy to march in literature. The transgression which all material objects undergo through the passion of the poet, this power which he exerts to dwarf the great, to magnify the small, and might be illustrated by 1,000 examples from his plays. I have before me The Tempest, and will cite only these few lines. Ariel. The strong-based promontory, have I made a shake, and by the spurs plucked up the pine and the cedar. Prospero called for music to soothe the frantic Alonso and his companions. A solemn air and the best confronter to an unsettled fancy cure with brains, now useless, boiled within my skull. Again, the charm dissolves apace, and the morning steals upon the night, melting the darkness so that rising senses begin to chase the ignorant fumes that mantle their clearer relation. Their understanding begins to swell, and the approaching tide will shortly fill the reasonable shores, and now lie foul and muddy. And the perceptions of real affinities, being events, that is to say, of ideal affinities for those who only are real, enables the poet thus to make free with the most imposing forms and phenomena of the world, and to assert the predominance of the soul. And three, wilt thou, poet, animate treasure with his own thoughts? He differs from the philosopher only herein, that the one proposes beauty and his main end, and the other truth. But the philosopher, not less than the poet, proposes the apparent order and relation of things to the empire of thought. The problem of philosophy, according to Plato, is, for all that exists conditionally, to find ground unconscient and absolute. It proceeds on the faith that a law determines all phenomena, which, being known, the phenomena can be predicted. The true philosopher and the true poet are one, and the beauty which is truth and a truth which is beauty, is the aim of both. Is not the charm or one of Plato's or Aristotle's definitions strictly like that of the Antigone of Sophocles? It is in both cases that a spiritual life has been imparted to nature, that the solid seeming block of matter has been pervaded and dissolved by a thought. This feeble human being has penetrated the vast reaches of nature with an adoring soul and recognizes that this is attained, and the people and the memory disburthens itself of its cumbrous catalogs of particulars. They carry centuries of observation in single form. Thus, even in events, the material is degraded before the spiritual, and the geometer, rely on their irrefragable analysis and disdain the results of observation. The sublime remark of Euler and his law of arches, this will be found contrary to all experience, yet is true, and already transferred nature into mind and left matters like an outcast corpse. Intellectual science, number 4, has been observed to beget invariably a doubt of the existence of matter. Turgot said, he that has never doubted the existence of matter may be assured he will know aptitude for metaphysical inquiries. It fastens the attention upon immortal uncreated natures, that is, upon ideas and their presence. We feel that the outward circumstance is a dream and a shade. Whilst we wait in the Olympus of gods, we think of nature as an appendix to the soul. We ascend into their region and know that these are the thoughts of the Supreme Being. These are they who were set up for this everlasting form, the beginning, or either the earth was, when he prepared the heavens. They were there when he established the clouds above. When he established the fountains of the deep, then they were him. Then they were by him, as one brought up with him of them took the counsel. Their influence is proportionate. As objects of science, they are accessible to few men. Yet all men are capable of being raised by piety or by passion into their religion, into their region, and in some degree, himself divine. Like a new soul, they renew the body. They become physically nimble and lightsome, and we tread on air. Life is no longer irksome, and we think it will never be so. No man fears age or misfortune or death in their serene company, for he is transported out of the district of change. And whilst we behold unveiled the nature of justice and truth, we learn the difference between the absolute. It, as it were, for the first time, we artists, we regions of matter that were a perception of truth or a virtue, a family, religion, and ethics, which may be fitly called the practice of ideas or the introduction of ideas into life, and have an analogous effect with all lower culture in ethics and religion, and differ in herein, that the one is the system of human duties, differ herein, and that the one is a system of the human duties commencing from man, the other does not. They are one to our present design. They both put nature underfoot. The first and last lesson of religion is the things that are seen are temporal. The things that are unseen are eternal. It puts an effort upon nature. It does that for the unschooled, which philosophy does for Bernanke and Visa. The uniform challenge that may be made in unsubstantial shows of the world, they are vanities, dreams, shadows, unrealities, seeker the realities of religion. And the devotee, false nature. Some theosophists have arrived at a certain hostility and indignation towards matter, as the Manchurian and Plotinus. They all wind up on the floor in the back seat with a bullet shot. And they disturbed the French pots of Europe, and Plotinus was ashamed of his body in short sight. They were a matter with Michelangelo, a set of external beauty. It is the frail and weary weed in which God dresses the soul, which he has called unto time. I'm getting there, folks. It appears that motion, poetry, physical and intellectual science, and religion all tend to affect our convictions of the reality of the external world. But I own there is something ungrateful in expanding to curiosity. The particulars of the general proportion at all culture tends to imbue us with idealism. I have no hostility to nature, but a child's love to it. I expand and live in the warm day corn and melon. Let us speak her fair. I do not wish to fling stones at my beautiful sister, nor soil my gentle nest. I only wish to indicate the true position of nature in regard to man, and wherein to establish man all right education in life, that is, of man's connection with nature, and now, of course, cult leader Obama. And he has a small note here. Leave Ralph. I'm very tired tonight. I don't know if I'll be able to continue this program. I find myself extremely tired. I've been reading this book today, from one chapter to the next, and it's very well written. Engaging. I guess you're supposed to put thatch on them. They deserve it. And you as well. Just go into the library and ask her. I want to finish where I was. We're almost done this, and only done half the program. But I don't know if I'll be able to go on tonight to continue. It appears that motion, poetry, physical and intellectual science, and religion all tend to affect our convictions of reality of the external world. But I own there is something ungrateful in expanding too curiously the particulars of the general population. That all cultures tend to imbue us with idealism. I have no hostility to nature, but a child's love for it. I expand and live in the warm day like corn and melons. Let us speak or fair. I do not wish to fling stones at my beautiful mother, nor soil my gentileness. I only wish to indicate the true position of nature in regard to man, wherein in establish man all right education detends, or rather tends, forgive me, I lost my spot here. The advantage of ideal theory over the popular faith is this, that it presents the world in precisely that view which is most desirable to man. It is, in fact, the view which Reagan both pointed out. The view which Reagan, both conservative and practical, that is philosophical in virtue. Take for a scene in the light of thought, the world always is phenomenal and views subordinates into the mind. Idealism sees the world in God. It provides, but as one vast picture with God's plans on the energy, on the instant and eternity for the contemplation of the soul. Therefore, the soul holds itself off from a taboo trial and microscopic study of the universal tablet. It represents the end too much to immerse itself in the means. It seems something more important in Christianity than the sand scandals, rather, of eclectical history, or the ninth of criticism and very curious concerns. However, it sees nothing more important to Christianity than the scandals of ecclesiastical history. The nice articles and very curious presidents of the Council on Foreign Relations, but as one vast picture with God paints on the instant celebrity for the contemplation of the soul, therefore the soul holds him off from a too tribal and spent fury all the money going into your account. I don't know what I'm talking about. Sorry. No man is its enemy, accepts whatever befalls as part of its lesson. It was a washer, doer, than a doer. It was a watcher more than a doer. It is a doer, only that it may be better watched. I think I'm going to end it there because I'm extremely tired tonight. But that was the essay on idealism. And I have a tendency to ramble a little bit. Tonight, I'm very excited that my book is out, you can buy a copy now on Amazon.com, and it's called Naked at the Mic, The Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril, and like I said, I'm very excited about it coming out, and I hope that that my listeners will consider looking at it. And possibly buying it. It is offered at Naked at the Mic, Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril. And and also blogtalkradio.lasteelshow.org. And if you go to my webpage, you'll see that I have see the many friends that I have, and many of them interested in chemtrails and interested in geoengineering and the human population reduction, which is what we talk about in Chapter 5. So I hope that you will be entertained, and hopefully we'll melt a little bit of ice tonight. But I want to thank everybody and wish you the best, and good night.